Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, I normally like doing this show because I love doing the show because to some extent we get to focus on other countries' problems and not how broken our own country is and how we seem to think it's normal to have a civilian population that's better armed than most foreign militaries and how they're increasingly targeting children in mass shootings. But here we are kicking off a show with another fucking mass shooting in Texas. The NRA convention is in Texas on Friday as well, so I'm sure they'll be thoughtful about all this.
Yeah, those people can go fuck off. It's like unfathomable to me that, you know, I don't know what to say that people don't always
Quick,
say.
I just watched Senator Chris Murphy, friend of the pod, on the floor, like, just so angry. It looked like he was about to rip up his desk and hulk it and throw it to the other side.
I mean, I guess you just have to say, as I think Chris Murphy would, as someone who never gives up on this, that, like, you just cannot allow yourself to be numbed to it. I have an elementary school age daughter, and I like the idea of dropping her off. I drop her off at school every day, and it's always like a slightly painful moment, you know, to like give her a hug. The idea of her not being there when I go to, I can't even what these parents are going through, and that this country and, you know, in states like Texas, frankly, prioritize like people having military weapons over the lives of their children, like, is the ultimate expression of who they think this country is.
It's pure nihilism.
Yeah.
Because it's not, after mass shootings like in El Paso, they have not made it harder to get guns. They have made it easier in some instances. Like, concealed carry goes away, and it's outrageous.
The point I keep coming back to, Tommy, like, is that we sat in fucking meetings in the White House Situation Room for hour after hour after hour, mobilizing trillions of dollars to meet a absolute, like, zero tolerance for someone, you know,
terrorist.
Like a terrorist, you know, killing a few people. Like, if a terrorist killed this many people with a truck bomb, we'd like go to war in three countries because of that, right? Mm-hmm. I took an airplane today, and I'm still wondering why the fuck I'm taking my shoes off.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that this country has such warped national security priorities that it compelled us to spend trillions of dollars and fight wars in, like, more countries than people are even aware of because of the risk of the kinds of attacks that kill less people than are killed each week in mass shootings in this country is the ultimate insane statement of a country's priorities.
And then Texas in August 2021, passed a law allowing permitless carry. I mean, it's outrageous.
You can walk around with a semi-automatic weapon strapped to your fucking leg in Texas, but take your shoes off to get on an airplane because 20 years ago, some guy, like, tried to light a match by a shoe. This is just insanity.
Well, we're going to try to channel our rage into action, because that's kind of what Crooked Media does here. We also have a great show today. I'm going to pivot to a happier sounding voice. We're talking about a lot of stuff. We're going to talk about U.S. policy toward Taiwan, Biden's trip to Asia, the latest from Ukraine, a plot to assassinate George W. Bush. That was a wild story. Somalia, charges of anti-Semitism, fascism, and U.S. policy towards Israel, and then some fun with MAGA grifters, and then maybe a little Boris partying at the end.
I mean,
we have time.
Why not?
Let's, we have to. Okay.
Mix that in.
And Ben, you did an excellent interview today with a VIP. What are we going to hear?
Yeah, we got another cabinet level official here, Ambassador Linda Thomas Greenfield, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, and the U.S. is the chair of the Security Council this month. We talk about the food crisis because of the war in Ukraine, which is taking up a lot of her attention. We talk about what it's like to deal with Russia at the U.N. and what the U.N. might need to change, given the fact that Russia obstructs everything at the Security Council with their veto. And we talk a bit about her efforts on a range of other humanitarian issues, including trying to get assistance into Syria, which does not get as much attention as other issues. So definitely worth checking out.
Oh, cool. I'll definitely listen to that.
And I will say, on sale day for the paperback of After the Fall.
There we go.
This is the day to get it fresh off the printing presses.
Buy
the book. It helps. If you buy it in the first couple weeks the paperback's out, that means they'll keep putting it on those tables in those bookstores, and that will really help this book have a life as a paperback. So please, please.
Got to be Kellyanne Conway. Okay, yeah. Let's start with some news from President Biden's first trip to Asia as president. So Biden went to South Korea and then Japan. At a press conference in Tokyo, President Biden and the Japanese prime minister were asked how Japan and the U.S. would respond if China tried to invade Taiwan. Good question. So first, Biden said our policy towards Taiwan has not changed at all. Then he goes into sort of an aside about how important it is that Putin pay a price for invading Ukraine. Then he says China's flirting with disaster by flying jets over Taiwan. And then he sort of reiterates that the U.S. supports the one China policy, but added, it does not mean that China has the jurisdiction to go in and use force to take over Taiwan. Then the reporter follows up, and this is where it gets complicated and interesting. Here's a clip.
You didn't want to get involved in the Ukraine conflict militarily for obvious reasons. Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's a commitment we made. That's a commitment we made. We are not. Look, here's the situation. We agree with a one China policy. We've signed on to it and all the attendant agreements made from there. But the idea that it can be taken by force, just taken by force, is just not appropriate. It will dislocate the entire region and be another action similar to what happened in Ukraine.
So real quick, the gist of the one China policy is that Biden mentioned there is that the U.S. recognizes the Chinese government in Beijing, but also believes, you know, Beijing and Taiwan need to sort out their historical differences peacefully. We can go with that history if you want, Ben. Yeah. But also we arm Taiwan and help it defend itself. So after the press conference ended, Ben and I got a flurry of emails from White House press corps folks. The White House officials told reporters that Biden's comments were to change in policy. But this is like the third time, I think, that he has suggested otherwise when it comes to Taiwan. He's leaned into a more of a hawkish position. Obviously, his words take on added meaning given what's happening in Ukraine and because the words were spoken in Japan. Where this threat feels even more real. Ben, what do you think is going on here? Is Biden overstating the policy and then walking it back? Is that the ultimate form of strategic ambiguity, a term we should explain?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. And first of all, I will say in that clip, it's always interesting when the reporter's like, ask a question and the answer is, she's like, you are?
Yeah.
Like, she did not expect to get the answer. Like, she expected to get the brush off.
But Ben, Politico had a description of all the sort of senior officials in the front row, and they said that Rahm Emanuel's eyes like bulged out of his head.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can say I've seen that.
You've seen that?
Not good when it happens. So first of all, this is a hugely impactful statement. And
and
what was particularly kind of unusual or strange to me in the answer is when he said, that's a commitment we made.
Right.
Because it's actually not like we, the U.S. has, does, we have
no treaty. I mean,
just to be very clear with people, like with Japan, we have a treaty. They are a treaty ally, like a NATO ally. And so if Japan is invaded by China, we have an obligation. We have a commitment we made to come to its defense. And we also have bases in Japan.
Right.
So we have like a military presence.
Like Article 5.
For that,
NATO.
Yeah, it's the same thing, right? We do not have that with Taiwan. We do have a commitment to kind of help support their military, but it is not like a defense commitment, like we will go to war to defend Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say that the one China policy that Biden referenced does feel like a bit rickety here in mm-hmm. the sense that, just to do the quick history piece of this, the government of Taiwan for a long time was basically the Chiang Kai-shek exiles from mainland China. The people who lost the Chinese Civil War to the Communist Party moved to Taiwan, where there, by the way, already were a bunch of people. And they kind of set up this government that was an autocracy, a U.S.-backed autocracy. And they claimed that they were also the government of China. When the United States repaired relations with the People's Republic of China, part of what we did is we said we recognize there's only one China, but everybody kind of thought.
Thank you, Dick Nixon, by the way.
Well,
shout out, Tricky Dick.
Shout out. It was the ultimate like kick a can down the road and assume right. that it all sorted itself out.
Right.
Well, what's happened ever since the Taiwan Relations Act around the Carter administration is that you've had the Taiwanese government become a democracy. You've had the Taiwanese government really lose its roots in that kind of mainland Chinese exile community.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to have anything to do with China. They don't want to be swallowed up by the People's Republic of China, which has also become much more belligerent. And the kind of negotiated settlement that they once envisioned, where you might have one country, two systems in China and Taiwan, they looked at that promise broken in Hong Kong, and the Taiwanese are like, we don't want any part of
this. Right.
So the idea that the U.S. needs to think about what does that mean, that is an important conversation. The problem is saying outrightly that you would go to war for Taiwan when we haven't made that kind of formal diplomatic commitment. Is that ironclad? Like, how do the Chinese react to that? The Taiwanese might want to like keep the strategic ambiguity because they don't want to provoke China into being more aggressive because they're trying to get out in front of the U.S. Getting more involved militarily. So, look, I understand what he's speaking to, which is like he doesn't want to look like he's hiding behind some gobbledygook diplomatic language, because usually you stand up and say, well, we have one China policy and we recognize, you know, the three communiques from decades ago. But this is one where if you can't explain after the fact what that means, I think that it doesn't really help add clarity.
It's all like, clearly Biden is trying to signal that he thinks it would be immoral, horrific, evil for China to
fair.
It's always funny though when you sort of lean too far over policy and then a bunch of senior officials have to give statements sort of like, no, nothing changed, I don't know what you're talking about.
What are you talking about? Nothing. But you're right that he's,
you know, your lying eyes.
He said this now like multiple times in very different venues. He said it in like a town hall once, I think.
Yes.
And so clearly Joe Biden believes this.
Where he is.
Like, and that matters. He's the president. But it does kind of call into question, though, like, what does that mean? Like, how do we square a status quo in which the United States formally says there's only one China and Taiwan is a part of it, with the idea that actually, no, this is a democracy that has moved in its own direction, that wants nothing to do with China, and the Chinese are building up their military to potentially invade that country? This is a huge flash button issue. And so I think that there should be more transparency and discussion about, like, what is our commitment? What are we willing to do? Why are we willing to do it? And what does it mean for our China policy writ large?
Yeah, for sure. A couple more notes from Biden's trip. So Biden met with the Quad, which is how NSC nerds try to brand meetings between the U.S., Australia, India, and Japan for some reason. In one of his press avails, Biden said that when he gets back home, he will talk to Secretary Yellen about potentially lifting U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods. Wall Street liked that a lot. Biden met with the new Prime Minister of Australia, Anthony Albanese, for the first time. Shout out to our Aussie friends for taking out Scott Morrison, the McDonald's.
Yeah, send him back to McDonald's. Yeah.
Send him back to McDonald's. A dozen or so countries announced the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which basically sounds like an intention to work together to try to forge new diplomatic agreements around trade, climate change, supply chain resiliency, and sort of tax and anti-corruption measures. Taiwan was not a part of that announcement, notably. And then finally, Biden was asked if he had a message for North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. He said, hello.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good,
that's
right?
That's a pretty good line, yeah.
Any meta takeaways in the rest of the trip for you, Ben?
I mean, they are clearly, well, first of all, like, the Albanese win, like, huge win for the planet. Great work.
Clap
Aussie
it up.
World does.
Labor Party did well. The independent parties did well. The Greens.
Yeah, the Greens. Like, and I think, you know, look, if you look at Canada, Australia, New Zealand, you've seen a succession of center-left victories. Hopefully that spreads to the United Kingdom as we're moving around the Commonwealth here. I think that they want to demonstrate that these relationships that they have in the Asia-Pacific region, or the Indo-Pacific region as it was rebranded in the Trump years,
great,
which is part of the point, is that India, they want to be a part of these conversations. They want to, and this is a Kurt Campbell special, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like our former colleague, Kurt Campbell.
I emailed him today because he got a shout out from the Australians.
But
he wrote me back while they were refueling in Alaska. Diligent,
well,
Kurt.
He's on it. He's
my
always
guy.
He's always working. But one of the things that we used to always talk about is, like, can you turn these relationships that we have in Asia into kind of an architecture? Like in the transatlantic relationship, you have, you know, NATO, and you have, you know, G7, which is a very European centric organization, even though you have Japan in there, and you have, you know, all manner of transatlantic institutions, the OSCE, a lot of acronyms. In Asia Pacific, you have the U.S. has a bunch of allies, and they're trying to create connectivity among those allies that begins to look like an architecture like we have in the U.S. and European relationship. So the Quad is an effort. The Quad also refers to the U.S. and France and Germany and the U.K.
That's why it's so confusing.
So I think they're trying to kind of signal, like, we're going to stitch together these relationships into something that is more of a structure, and we're going to engage the 10 Southeast Asian countries. That's ASEAN. And we're going to, you know, go to the East Asia Summit where we meet with ASEAN. The challenge with this is that, you know, what is the what at the end of the day? And I think that the trade and investment framework thing that you mentioned, you know, raises one of the awkward realities for them, which is that the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement was that before.
And the Japanese prime minister said, like, well, I wish you'd get back into the TPP, but this is okay. We'll talk about this.
Yeah, so, like, that's a formal trade agreement that the U.S. negotiated that then all the other parties to that agreement joined it, but the U.S. pulled out because Trump was against it. Okay.
And Hillary.
So maybe you don't like free trade agreements, but the question is, can this become something that is actually meaningful and is not just something you announce on a trip, but something that has depth and weight to it? So I think, look, they're drawing the outlines of what they would like the future of collaboration in this region to look like. They want India in the deal. They want these countries talking not just to the United States, but to each other. That's all good, but there's just a lot of follow-through that's going to have to come behind it.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of time. Last really quick thing. You mentioned New Zealand. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern is in the U.S. She's going to New York, D.C., and Boston. It's mostly a trade mission, but she's giving the commencement at Harvard University. Very fancy. Congratulations. What is TBD, however, is whether she'll meet with Joe Biden in D.C. because she got COVID.
Or come to Potsie at the World.
On May 14th.
She's invited here.
Well, that's what I'm going to say. Yeah. So she got COVID. She had to isolate. There's some sort of, like, I don't know, they're trying to figure out if she can get in there to see Biden. I don't know. It's been like more than 10 days since her diagnosis, the anxiety. They could just sit outside on the porch outside the Oval, whatever. But what I'm trying to say is, Prime Minister Ardern, if you want to fill the void of not having a Biden meeting, give us a call. Come on the show.
Always welcome at this table.
Huge fans.
Like I say, I think, look, it's really important that the U.S. express, like, support for leaders trying to do the right thing. So I hope that they're able to meet her. You know,
she's one of the most successful leaders of the last half decade.
Well, and Trump wraps his arms around people like, you know, Viktor Orban. And like, I think we should be less bashful on the center left progressive side of things in, you know, backing up our people around the world.
Yeah, I think it's just a COVID thing. And they're kind of like,
no, I know. And it's not a shot at that. I'm just saying, I hope it works out.
Yeah, me too. Okay, let's talk about Ukraine. Because the war has been raging for exactly 3 months as we record. So a quick little roundup of news. A guy named Boris Bondarev, a diplomat at Russia's mission to the United Nations in Geneva, resigned, went public with his criticism. Ben, I hope this guy has been approached by some intelligence service and offered some protection, because this kind of stuff gets you killed.
Yeah, you get poisoned.
By Putin. Yeah, somewhere like you have tea in London and all of a sudden things go south. Russia has been caught stealing Ukrainian grain reserves, just in case you didn't think Putin was a monster. Russian ships have taken Ukrainian grain to Syria and to parts of Crimea that they control. Russia is also blockading Ukrainian ports and preventing food and fertilizer exports, which is exacerbating global shortage and famine. I want to dig into that a little more in a second. The British government has decided now is a good time to cut direct humanitarian aid in half. Boris had to find a way to pay for all those parties, I guess. Ukrainian court sentenced a captured Russian soldier to life in prison. The U.S. is now very publicly speculating on secondary sanctions, something we've talked about in the past, ways to punish countries for buying Russian oil or potentially setting like an artificially low cap that you have to pay, like break even for Russia is like $40 a barrel, and maybe saying to the international community, you can buy at this price, but any more we'll sanction the shit out of you. And then the last thing is the first of these American-made M777 howitzers are slowly getting deployed. They're active in Ukraine. That means the Ukrainian military now has this very lethal long-range artillery capability, so they can fire from even further away than the Russians can. And it comes as fighting in eastern Ukraine is getting more intense and brutal. Zelensky, I think, I don't know if this is for the first time, said that up to 100 Ukrainian soldiers a day are dying or getting killed. So that's a pretty stark casualty count. So, Ben, the New York Times ran an editorial the other day calling on Biden to basically lay out goals in an endgame. They wrote, a decisive military victory for Ukraine over Russia, in which Ukraine regains all the territory Russia has seized since 2014, is not a realistic goal. They basically said, you have to tell Zelensky that there's a limit to U.S. support. Get ready to cut a deal. This pissed off basically everyone in Ukraine, a lot of progressives, a lot of conservatives. Where are you like 3 months into this? Because you and I talked a lot about like an off-ramp. talks between Zelensky and Russia, us facilitating them. But I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure. Like, a lot of people are saying no, there's a chance for them to roll back Russia completely and maybe, I don't know, check Russian imperialism or militarism for a longer time frame.
I think, first of all, like all the things you say speak to kind of a third phase of the war, right? Like a phase one was this kind of failed effort by Russia to decapitate the Ukrainian government. Phase two was this kind of beginning of the protracted fight that is still ongoing in the Donbass and southern Ukraine. This phase is also about just kind of sustainment. And if you look at the different things you mentioned, right, you worry about, will all the assistance to Ukraine start to dry up when it's no longer like the headline news, yeah. right? Like a Boris Johnson who jumped on the PR bandwagon. Is he going
to
be there? He
went to Kiev like 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. Is he going to be there in 3 months, 6 months? The sanctions, the holes that emerge in sanctions regimes are when basically other countries around the world are like, we're going to keep buying this Russian oil and we're going to keep doing business with these people. And then the secondary sanctions you say is, are we going to be willing to kind of go around and sanction other countries, not Russia, but the countries that continue to do business with Russia? That is harder to do. It is time consuming. It is difficult. It is economically disruptive. But that is going to be required if you really want this pressure to stick on the Russians. And all of this leads to the question of like, well, how does this end if we're in this kind of grinded out, protracted, really deadly fighting in eastern Ukraine and southern Ukraine, and there's this kind of status quo hardening? I see where the New York Times editorial is coming from, right? Like if you want just an end to the killing, you know, if basically someone could say, hey, like, you know, go back to the way things were at the beginning of this war, which is kind of what the Times is suggesting. And that's better than all these people dying every day. I understand where that impulse comes from, but very big but. First of all, like, we don't get to decide. Yeah. I mean, like, I think, you know, whatever you think, the Ukrainians are the one whose country was invaded. And if the Ukrainians don't feel like they can say, yeah, like, you can keep Mariupol and you can keep the whole Donbass if we just have a ceasefire, if they're not going to do that, this is kind of like a discussion that assumes we have more agency than I think we do, unless we're willing to say, hey, we're going to stop giving you weapons unless you agree to this, which I think...
And that's kind of where the Times is getting at, I think.
And
saying,
I don't,
like, we might cut off, you know,
40... I wouldn't
40,
do that. Yeah.
Well, and to your point, I mean, it does seem like President Zelensky has zero running room here. I mean, I saw the Kiev Independent said that there was a poll that showed that basically 82% of Ukrainians refused to leave territory under Russian occupation. I think that was the statistic.
He was willing, by the way, to the off-ramp advocates, like, of which, you know, I've been one a lot, but like, he was willing in the early days of the war. He made noises about saying he wouldn't join NATO.
Yeah.
He made noises about, you know, Crimea, we understand there's a status quo there.
Send his defense minister to negotiations.
And then the Russians basically destroyed Mariupol and, you know, committed all manner of war crimes around Kyiv. And you can understand why they're not in a position yet to say, well, you know, these parts of our country are occupied and there are mass deportations and killings happening in those parts of the country. But, you know, the people in Davos say, like, we need an off-ramp. I mean, like, they want an off-ramp. I bet you that the Ukrainians would like an off-ramp from the war. I just think it's we have to be humble about our capacity to dictate that off-ramp. And we also have to understand here that, like, you know, Vladimir Putin gets a vote too. And the reality is, like, we did pause this war. There was a negotiated kind of quasi-ceasefire for a bunch of years. And it's not like that ended the war. The Minsk agreements were reached in 2015.
Yep.
So it's just more complicated. Like, I understand where this is coming from, but, like, I think the Ukrainians have to be the ones to dictate what kind of end state they can live with. And, you know, we're not, I think, at the point yet where we can tell them 3 months into this thing, hey, like, we're going to cut you off if you don't agree to X, Y, and Z.
Here's one area where the clock is really ticking, which is this issue of an impending food shortage. Because we've got You know, Russians now, we're learning, they're stealing grain from Ukrainian silos. Farmers can't plant for obvious reasons because they're fighting or their fields are being blown up. Russia is sanctioned, so they can't export things. Commercial ships can't get to Ukrainian ports and move their stored grain abroad because the Russian Navy is blockading the ports. Experts are saying that we might have, you know, a couple months before this becomes a huge crisis, especially in poor countries. And on top of that, Russia is a huge exporter of fertilizer. And so I was listening to like a BBC World Service report today about a farmer, a rice farmer in Thailand, who's not going to be able to have the same crop that he normally has because he can't get his hands on fertilizer. So like, this is a ticking time bomb for the world, for the poorest countries in the world, more than anybody.
Yeah. No, and I talked to Linda Thomas Greenfield about this, the ambassador to the UN, in the interview. I think that one of the things that needs to be done is, you know, some of the remaining islands of support, or not support, but kind of fence sitting vis-a-vis Russia, are in parts of the world that are quite vulnerable to these food shortages. And so I think diplomatically, you have to stitch together an effort to try to unlock at least some of the flow of this wheat and other and fertilizer from Odessa port in Ukraine, from you know, all the blockaded material that's not getting out of Ukraine. Like, this is one where it shouldn't just be the U.S. and Europe. Like, everybody has skin in this game. And yeah. I do think that if you have a different assortment of countries in this vis-a-vis Russia saying, like, you know, you are going to kill untold numbers of people in all parts of the world and unleash greater instability, like, you just got to keep pushing and pushing on this.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to talk about an assassination plot against George W. Bush. Okay, Ben. So here is a very weird story. The FBI arrested a Columbus, Ohio man named Shihab Ahmed Shihab for allegedly trying to get 4 to 6 individuals from Iraq into the U.S. via Mexico to kill former President George W. Bush. The attack was supposed to be in the name of ISIS. This guy was, I guess, under FBI surveillance the whole time, so presumably there wasn't huge risk.
Yeah, yeah.
He was talking to a confidential U.S. informant. Yeah. Doesn't seem like Bush was in any real danger, but he did travel to Dallas and take video around Bush's home, so it's scary. I never know. The FBI always like announces and rolls up these plots where like they've been communicating with some 19-year-old, gave him an inert bomb, said planted at this parade, like something like that. And it's always hard to judge like how real the threat was or was not, or if this is just, you know, an idiot that got pulled into something. But I don't know, caught my eye.
Yeah, no, it would. But I think that the way in which you try to separate it is like, is there some kind of formal terrorist organizational planning behind this? You know, is there an Al-Qaeda cell somewhere plotting this or whatever? This has the flavor of like a radicalized individual like texting with the FBI, feels less acute than other threats, although it reminds you what's out there. It reminded me of that Iranian, you know, that plot where allegedly they were going to smuggle people across the Mexican border and then
to
assassinate
DC, right?
The Saudi ambassador in Cafe Milano.
Yeah, and like a Georgetown, like ritzy restaurant.
Yeah, yeah. Which again, like, I there may very well have been some planning behind it, but, you know, sometimes the ambition outstrips like anything that is actually going to happen, you know?
Yeah, I remember Ben and I used to share an office in the basement of the West Wing. I remember that one breaking and kind of looking at each other being like, what?
I don't think so. Yeah, like that's crazy. Like, but this one feels, I mean, that one though, there was like, I think some chatter and some, the potential IRGC involvement. This feels like a guy sitting at his computer talking to the FBI.
Yeah. You know? Speaking of counterterrorism, so last week, the New York Times reported that President Biden signed an order redeploying hundreds of special operations forces to Somalia. So that reversed a decision by Trump that he made on his way out the door to pull about 700 guys, ground troops, from the country. Biden is not sending that full number back in. Force is going to be capped at 450, but he's also given the Pentagon the authority to target about a dozen leaders of al-Shabaab, which is a terrorist group in Somalia that pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda back in 2012. So that's why I think they're treated pretty differently. The Somali parliament selected a new president in early May. They welcomed this announcement. So, Ben, it seems like this might be, I can't tell how big of a change this is, because some of the reporting suggested that U.S. military trainers were basically flying in and out of Somalia for 2 months at a time. That approach was wasteful, ineffective, dangerous, kind of like screwing up the mission. But I don't know. I mean, it's also kind of hard for me to judge at this point, like a decade after reading intelligence, how much of a threat Al-Shabaab is.
Well, and a decade of this approach, you know, which again, like, you know, full disclosure, like the Obama administration pursued, the Trump administration pursued. So this is not one that in any way originated with Biden. But like, to me, one other thing to look at is the pace of drone strikes in Somalia, mm-hmm. which, you know, there have been a lot of allegations of civilian casualties over the years. And Al-Shabaab is still there, despite all this effort. And you would like to see more of a focus on the political viability of Somalia, which is, by the way, also at great risk from these food shortages that we just talked about. Like, we talk about ending forever wars. This is a reminder that's not just Afghanistan. Like, that's Somalia as well as other places.
Number so
I think the thing to watch is this a training mission? Is there an uptick in drone activity and kind of U.S. kind of direct military activity in Somalia or not? If it's just, like, something to facilitate additional training, I think that's less of an escalation than if more special ops leads to more drone strikes, which leads to kind of just more U.S. involvement in the conflict that is, you know, doesn't appear to have a military solution when it's been going on for not just a decade, but in some ways several decades.
Yeah, and I think it's a question of, is this really a super targeted effort to get Al-Shabaab leadership, or are there going to be a bunch of drone strikes on, you know,
fighters,
what is assumed to be a dozen guys in the back of a truck who are presumed to be fighters that are doing something that looks nefarious to someone.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a big distinction.
Yeah. And you got to make sure that all these countries in the region are on board here and rowing in the same direction. And so it's not just a kind of a U.S. And that's generally been the case. You've had Kenya play a big role here. Yeah. But, you know, I don't think turning the escalation dial back up makes a lot of sense at this point.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting that the super targeted sort of intelligence version is perfect either.
By the way, this is another reason why there should be a new authorization for the use of military force out of Congress, right? Because, like, we are in Somalia at war under the authority granted to George Bush after 9/11. Mm-hmm. Now, the legal rationale, and I know because it was in the Obama administration too, is that because Al-Shabaab pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda like a decade ago.
2012,
they're an associated force, and that is past its expiration date, and it has been for a long time. This is a reason why if the U.S. thinks it should be at war with a terrorist organization in Somalia, the executive branch should be able to go to Congress and say, hey, Congress, vote to authorize the deployment of these special forces to Somalia. That doesn't happen, and that's part of the way you get forever wars. And again, that's on everybody. That's on
Democrats,
Republicans, Obama, Biden, you know, definitely Congress.
For sure. Okay, let's dive into the not at all sensitive topic of anti-Semitism, nationalism, and support for Israel. Excited?
Yeah, that always works out well.
It works out well for everybody. Yeah. So first, a little background. So the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, is happening in Hungary this week. President Trump spoke to it via video, so did Tucker Carlson. CPAC Hungary also featured a notorious Hungarian racist who uses racial epithets to describe black people and refer to Jews as, quote, stinking excrement. I have not seen CPAC Hungary get called out for featuring the speaker or condemned by the ADL or relevant groups. The ADL, however, did condemn the communications director of a progressive group called the Justice Democrats for tweeting a joke about a fictional news outlet called Goy Outsider. He was retweeting an article from the Jewish Insider, making a stupid joke. Whatever. Now, Ben, I'm not the arbiter of things anti-Semitic or not. I've been called a goy a lot of times in my life, usually by my Jewish friends who make fun of me for being the most Aryan-looking person they've ever seen.
I think I've probably called you a goy.
But I don't know if you have a...
I don't know if I've called you a goy outsider, but yeah. I think I've called you separately a goy and an outsider.
Do you have a gut check on goy? Does that one ring your any bells for you?
Is
that bother
canceled?
You?
I don't...
I have no idea.
I, look, I this is worth look, the Hungary situation, you know, Viktor Orban is an anti-Semite who engages in not just dog whistles, but, you know, dog shouts at George Soros as his
right.
shadowy international
all
financier,
day, every day,
seeking to control Hungarian politics. Like, I've been to Budapest and been shown, like, the kind of rehabilitation of like fascist era Hungarian collaborative governments and the diminishment of what happened to the Jews in Hungary, in part because of the collaboration of their own government. Like, the bill of goods that one could assemble on Viktor Orban as an anti-Semite is very clear. What he's also done is he forged an alliance with Bibi Netanyahu. There was a total alliance of convenience wherein Viktor Orban would block EU efforts to support the Palestinians. And then Bibi Netanyahu would say, oh, no, Viktor Orban, he's a good guy. And oh, by the way, like, Viktor Orban's first political consultants when he ran for prime minister in 2010 had been previously Bibi Netanyahu. So there's just kind of this weird
nexus.
It's a right-wing thing. It's not an ethno-religious thing. But it's uncomfortable. And look, I write about this in my book out on paperback today about being spied on by Black Cube, an outfit of former Mossad agents who were also spying on Hungarian civil society on behalf of Viktor Orban. It's a very strange set of bedfellows happening here. To get to the ADL point, though, it's a total absurd joke for them to be singling out like that kind of speech, you know, Goy outsider as the issue. Like, the
right.
issue, and I talk about this with Hungarian Jews in my book, like, the rise of right-wing ethno-nationalism is a problem.
It doesn't end well for Jews specifically.
It's a problem for the Jewish people specifically. These are not forces that you want to align yourself with or make alliances of convenience with. It always leads to the worst possible places for Jews. And yes, is there some like hatred directed at Israel that speaks to a dangerous strain of anti-Semitism? Yes. I would also argue, though, that like the rise of far-right nationalism around the world cries out for attention from organizations like the ADL
yeah.
that are dedicated to combating anti-Semitism. And this kind of like putting points on the board against the progressive left in this country, like on behalf of Israel, is not the center of gravity of where people should be focused on anti-Semitism.
So let me flesh this out, because I agree. And I think I don't raise this CPAC Hungary and what was said about Walid just to do whataboutism, right? Because that's not what I'm trying to do here. But I think that when charges of anti-Semitism or criticism of, you know, policy towards Israel is used to just sort of attack political opponents, that's where you get into trouble. For example, you mentioned this last week. AIPAC's Political Action Committee is called United Democracy Project. It was ostensibly created to support pro-Israel candidates. The group spent over $2 million attacking a Democratic congressional candidate named Summer Lee in Pennsylvania's 12th district by saying she isn't a real Democrat. But AIPAC also endorsed over 100 Republican candidates who voted to overturn the 2020 election results. So that's just as cynical an attack as you can get.
Including some who have quite flirtatious relationships with far-right nationalists.
For sure. The similar group, the Democratic Majority for Israel, DMFI, in 2020, DMFI spent millions of dollars attacking Congressman Jamal Bowman in his primary against then-Congressman Elliot Engel. One of the ads said Bowman had unpaid taxes, and DMFI left it on air despite Engel telling them to pull it. My point is, if you want to attack political candidates for being insufficiently pro-Israel, by all means do. But endorsing insurrectionists and then calling Summer Lee a bad Democrat is just too cynical for me not to call out. Similarly, when the ADL criticizes a dumb joke like Walid's Goy outsider and then tells the press specifically, their spokespeople said, we did this because his organization, the Justice Democrats, criticizes Israel. That is also bad because you aren't objectively calling out anti-Semitism. You are saying liberals who criticize the Israeli government need to be on notice. We will check your ass.
We will primary your ass. And this is
But the random spokesman for the Justice Democrats, like, we're going to fucking destroy your reputation for the rest of your life because you're part of an organization that, you know, criticizes settlement construction. But Donald Trump can go to CPAC Hungary, say whatever he wants.
Yes, this is the point.
But as long as he's up Bibi's ass, we will never criticize him. And that, in my opinion, harms efforts to call out and stop anti-Semitism.
It is flat out dangerous and disingenuous. It's bullshit. And look, if they wanted to sit down and have a debate and say, okay, Justice Democrats, let's sit down and argue about Israeli-Palestinian policy. That'd be one thing. The fact that they run ads that don't even, like, this is what is so, like, this is the biggest tell in the world. They're not even running ads saying, here's something that X congressional candidate said about Israel, like, we believe this. No, they run bullshit ads saying that they're bad Democrats or they're scary this or scary that. They're not even willing to engage in that debate. They just kind of, you know, they dump money on people's heads and then call people who point that out anti-Semites, you know? And that is bad for everybody. Like, that is... And it's the ADL and this whole, like, whatever happened to, like, the social justice traditions in the American Jewish community that literally, like, used to make arguments on behalf of Israel, like, based on social justice.
Values.
Now are making arguments based on ethno-nationalism, which is not the argument that I think is the one that ends well for the Jewish people.
Or anybody.
Anywhere.
And by the way, there might be some listeners who think you're just defending your buddies in the Justice Democrats or in DSA, the Democratic Socialists.
I don't know. I've never met most of these people.
Just to be clear, like, I think when the DSA attacked Jamal Bowman for supporting the Iron Dome system, that was incredibly stupid.
I think even dumber when they attacked him for visiting Israel with the J Street trip. So, I'm more than happy to.
Some of the people, some of the leftists who are part of the DSA have been some of the most vicious critics of me personally, of you, of the media, right? So we're not defending our buddies. Like, I think I have a little more credibility here to call out what is actually a really bad faith attack against Waleed, Bernie Sanders, Summer Lee, Jennifer Cisneros down in Texas. Like, they're just attacking, these groups are pretending to be in support of pro-Israel policies, but they're just attacking progressive Democrats. And I think we should call it out because they're spending a ton of money.
And they're pushing people away from a constructive conversation.
Especially young Jews.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's just, anyway. Okay. Well, that will certainly not get us in any trouble on the internet.
I waited about this, like, Mike Pompeo called me an anti-Semite.
So, oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good. Honestly, enemies like that, it's kind of a good thing. Speaking of MAGA grifters, Ben.
Mike Pompeo?
Credit to the New York Times for continuing to report on Jared Kushner and Steve Mnuchin's new investment firms. They pointed out that Jared's final three trips to the Middle East after the election and Mnuchin's Middle East swing after the election, it was cut short by the insurrection, by the way, clearly mixed government and future business interests. They also reported on how both of them hired a bunch of people from their respective sort of government teams, the sort of Abraham Accord teams, to set up these new investment shops, despite not having any investment experience. I think these stories are still kind of missing the other piece of this, which is this inherent suggestion that Jared Kushner is making when he goes to a foreign government for investment money, which is to say, daddy's running again.
Yeah.
I'll be back in there. Don't you worry.
Yeah. I mean, like, this is the thing. I mean, these guys literally cashing in while they're in government, like greasing their post-government careers to the tune of billions of dollars, a scale of corruption that, you know, we just haven't seen.
Unfathomable.
Yeah. But also, like, clearly, very clearly trading on the likelihood that, you know, Trump is going to run again, and maybe these guys, you know, think that they're making a down payment on the next administration as well, knowing that people like Jared will deliver the goods for them. And also, like, by the way, undermining, I mean, yeah, the quaint notion that we have a president now who has interests, like, that he's seeking to deal with in that region, and these guys are like, no, like, you know, wait it out. Like, we'll do everything you want.
You covered.
Yeah.
The other thing we learned last week is that the Department of Justice is suing disgraced casino magnate Steve Wynn for lobbying for Trump on behalf of the Chinese government when he was finance chairman of the RNC. Wynn tried to get a Chinese billionaire dissident deported, and then he tried to help out his business in Macau. So, great stuff happening.
These are the people that, you know...
this is just shocking corruption.
Well, and it's like, you know, Mnuchin and to a lesser extent, Steve Wynn are supposed to be like the, you know, more mainstream MAGA grifters, I guess. Like,
yeah, they're sort of...
They've been around for... Like, it just...
Business people.
Everybody, it's just... When you have a corrupt enterprise like this, like, it makes... Like, it brings out the worst aspects of... I mean, like, Steve Wynn, you know...
He's disgraced for other
Me Too reasons, yeah.
Pretty
disgraceful guy to begin with. So I'm not suggesting... But, like, it is the case that these aren't just, like, the Seb Gorkas and the, you know, Alex Joneses and the... you know, this is the entire enterprise of this is what Trumpism is about in the end. It's basically people weaponizing ethno-nationalism and grievance for personal profit, you know, talking out of one mouth about how tough they are on the Chinese while they're like seeking to deport Chinese billionaires and get like Macau casino licenses. Like, it's all a grift, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Steve Wynn's just like taking calls from the vice premier and thinking that's just another thing he can trade and, you know, pass the message along to Donald Trump and then help out his casino.
Yeah.
It's so brazen. Also, he could have avoided these charges if he just filed under FARA, the Foreign Agent Registration Act, but he refused to do it.
Yeah,
which, you know, probably tells you everything you need to know about how these rich guys think about laws.
Well, that's exactly the point. It tells you that a guy like Steve Wynn thinks that if I do my RNC duty, like, I don't have to follow law. And that's what they think. They think the law doesn't apply to them.
Yeah, well, in fact, Trump did pardon Elliot Broidy, who was accused of, you know, sort of similar crimes. He pardoned Steve Bannon. So
pardon all these guys, jokers, Mike Flynn. And like, so they have already, like, we always have the threats to democracy and where we're going. Like, we are here. We are living in a country where there are different sets of laws that have been applied to these people. And they're trying to build an entire system where that is made permanent. You know, like, that is the stakes involved here.
Meanwhile, in the actual Middle East, President Biden has reportedly decided to keep the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps on the Foreign Terrorist Organization list, which is a Trump-era sanction that will probably do nothing in practice to hurt Iran, but will prevent Iran from getting back the nuclear deal.
This sanction, it was put in place by Trump after he pulled out of the JCPOA precisely because it was meant to be politically difficult for a future Democratic president to lift this sanction to get back in the JCPOA. This sanction does fucking nothing. The IRGC is not coming out with their hands up and saying, hey, we surrender, guys. We give up. We're going to stop our malign behavior and give up our nuclear program because you put us on a list, okay?
No, in fact.
Whereas, like, the JCPOA would roll back their nuclear program. So given the choice, you have a choice. Do I keep a meaningless designation that has a political benefit in the United States, or do I roll back the Iranian nuclear program and avert a potential nuclear crisis in the Middle East? Deciding that designation is more important than that deal will never make any sense. So you know where I stand on that issue.
In fact, Iran, I think this week, vowed revenge in Israel for the assassination of an Iranian colonel in Tehran. I guess this guy was linked to plots to kidnap Israeli diplomats abroad. Someone pulled up next to him on a motorcycle, shot into his car 5 times. He's dead. Now Iran's plotting their revenge. So yeah, it doesn't seem like the malign activities have stopped. Hopefully
they cave, by the way. I mean, hopefully the Iranians still come in this deal. Like, this could still have a good ending. I don't think this sanction, people need to be making the point I'd like someone to lay out what has it been accomplished. Like, look at the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard's behavior before this sanction and after. Is anything different?
No.
Yeah.
Last thing on the Middle East, Biden is reportedly considering a visit to the Middle East in June. A visit to Israel might be on the table, and a meeting with Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince who likes bone saws and executing American journalists. So
it's not worth it.
Depressing state of affairs in terms of the political risk to Biden from high gas prices, at least in his advisor's heads, versus, you know, the risk of meeting with someone who is a sociopath.
Yeah. It's not worth it. It's just not worth it, you know? And by the way, it's not like, do we really think Mohammed bin Salman is going to solve our gas price problem?
No, I think he's just going to wait it out for Trump to come back.
Yeah.
That's what he wants.
Otherwise, he wouldn't be sinking $2 billion into Jared Enterprises.
Nope. Yeah. Nope. He's got his down payment in. Last thing, Ben, did you see that ITV got a hold of pictures of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson partying during lockdown? ITV has been owning the story, by the way.
And there's like a lot of booze on the table.
So he's boozing with like 9 people. There's bottles everywhere. He's raising literally doing a toast with some bubbly. This rager was on November 13th, 2020. I think that is like almost the exact day when Hannah and I canceled our flights to see her parents for Thanksgiving, so we knew it was unsafe. It was a going away party for his communications director at Downing Street, who presumably knew that lockdown rules were in place and you were only allowed to mix 2 people from different households. Also, complicating this for Boris, the police fined others who were at this rager, but not Boris. Boris got fined for being at a different rager. The full official report on partying and culture at number 10 comes out this week. It could not be more obvious that Boris lied to Parliament and the British people. Here's a fun little clip of how ITV described it.
Have these photos taken the fizz out of his defense?
Because they call champagne
fizz.
Oh, I didn't
know that that clip was coming. That, that is so perfect.
It seems like he's going to get away with it, though.
Yeah, because he doesn't give a shit. There's like a bottomless absence of shame. I will, like, what is next here? Like, did you ever have those ragers in college where you had like the bathtub full of like the Everclear punchers?
Oh,
like, I could literally see these guys like dipping, like sharing like some, I don't know.
No, yeah, they're going to come out with Boris Johnson at the ice
like
luge
swimming
during
yeah,
lockdown.
Like swimming in a hot tub full of booze with like a bunch of staffers. I mean, like, what more do we need to establish that this guy broke the rules and thought there were one set of rules that applied to everybody else? And I don't know. And what are these ragers like, these Tory party? I mean, maybe they're fun. I don't know. Like,
well, we did read about all the cocaine.
Well, maybe Madison Cawthorn was a little confused. Maybe he was over there and they're doing key bumps in the bathroom, you know, at Toya HQ. I don't know.
Like, he just connected the dots for me.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Okay. Well, you know, we exercised some demons. I'm sure the Daily Wire is going to have fun with this episode. When we come back, you will hear Ben's interview with Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield. So stick around for that.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm very pleased to be joined by the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, a member of the Biden Cabinet National Security Team, longtime outstanding diplomat for our country, Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben. I'm really delighted to be here. It's great to see you.
Yeah. So I you know, there's so much going on up there. And obviously, the U.S. has had a little extra work, too, as chair of the U.N. Security Council. Obviously, Ukraine is what people are focused on. And I want to get to a couple elements there. But I just want to, people follow the developments on the ground in Ukraine. They follow military developments. But I'm just curious if you could lay out for our listeners, what is the center of gravity on Ukraine at the UN? What are you focused on up there? What aspects of the war are crossing your desk or crossing the attention of the Security Council?
Well, certainly what we worked on last week was food insecurity. That is a huge, huge issue. The food insecurity issue was an issue before Ukraine, but it has been made 10 times worse by the war. I've learned just over the course, it's only been 3 months, believe it or not, but that Ukraine is really the breadbasket of the world. World Food Program purchased 50% of the wheat that they use for humanitarian programs in Ukraine. And Ukraine provides wheat to a number of countries in the Middle East, as well as Africa, that depend on somewhere around 35 to 40% of their wheat requirements come from Ukraine. Some come from Russia as well. And both Russia and Belarus are the main source of fertilizer. So that has become a huge issue in the midst of this this horrific war, this horrific unconscionable attack on the Ukrainian people that we're watching on a daily basis. And we have engaged on this issue in the Security Council. And you may be aware, we actually took the vote to the General Assembly and got 141 member states to condemn the Russians. 140 states supported Ukraine for humanitarian assistance. And then we were able to successfully suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council. These are all extraordinary achievements. They have isolated the Russians here in the Security Council, and we're working with our partners and colleagues in the Council, as well as in the General Assembly, to continue to put the pressure on the Russians to stop their unconscionable attack on the Ukrainian people.
On the food insecurity issue, a couple questions. The first is, are there particular countries, regions that are facing kind of really acute challenges, risks of famine, or places in the Horn of Africa or Ethiopia where there's already conflicts where this could make worse? What keeps you up at night in terms of the places that are most vulnerable to these disruptions?
Well, we're certainly, just to look at the Middle East, Lebanon is in critical condition as a result of this war, because they depended on the majority of their wheat from Ukraine. And the situation there has gotten decidedly worse since this war started. Somalia is another country in the Horn of Africa where we are on the verge of famine because of the lack of wheat. Ethiopia, in the midst of a conflict, depended upon Ukrainian wheat as well. So there are a number of countries and regions that have been impacted. We hosted a ministerial in New York, chaired by Secretary Blinken, and brought together about 30 countries who signed on to an action plan to address food insecurity. And again, we know food insecurity has been impacted by the pandemic. It's been impacted by climate change, but the impact that this war has had is extraordinary. For example, there are 22 million tons of wheat sitting in silos in Ukraine that can't move. 84 ships sitting in the Black Sea that the Russians have blockaded in the Black Sea that can't move. They're trapped in the ports in Odessa port. So this is having a serious impact on food insecurity.
And in terms of solution, I mean, you've got the Russians literally, as you said, blocking wheat and other material from getting out. Then you've got, I think, a challenge from some countries that tend to hoard their food supplies, particularly when there's global shortages. And then there's just a question of, is there any ramp up in capacity that can come from other places? I mean, what is the formula that you all are pursuing globally to try to address these shortages, and what tools do we have to bring to bear for that?
Well, first and foremost, we're encouraging countries not to restrict exports, not to shut down their exports. There are a number of countries that have taken those decisions, and we're engaging with them on a regular basis to discourage them from taking these decisions. Secondly, we are looking at other sources of product that might come from other regions and encouraging countries to look at those other sources. And then as more a response to the crisis, we have ramped up our humanitarian assistance in response to the situation in Ukraine. As you may have heard, the president just signed a bill providing $44 billion in assistance, and a significant portion of that will be going toward humanitarian assistance, while some of it, of course, will be supporting the Ukrainians' effort to defend themselves against the Russians.
So I wanted to ask you kind of a broader question, which is that, you know, look, the 8 years I was in government, the Russians in particular became more, I think, aggressive in utilizing their veto and their role in the UN system to obstruct progress, including on Syria, which I was going to get to in a second here. But, you know, the Ukraine, I think, has really spotlighted this. And there's nothing, you know, you or anybody could do about the fact that, you know, literally the day the invasion starts, I think we all remember the Russians are like sitting in the chair of the Security Council, kind of embodied
the president of the Security Council.
Yeah, exactly, right? And nothing could more starkly demonstrate the way in which the international system that was built to prevent these kinds of conflicts, to prevent the kind of famine that is coming out of these conflicts, that the Russians are just sitting there throwing wrenches in the gears, stopping it from doing what the United Nations was supposed to do. Is there like a conversation about, is there a reform that can deal with that? Is there a process by which the UN can free itself to some extent from this? Or does that just require such a radical redesign of something that is 75 years old that it's difficult to think of on a day-to-day basis?
Not so radical. Two things have happened since this situation occurred. One, we have, in a sense, marginalized the Russians. We've blunted their veto power by going to the General Assembly. And we've seen the General Assembly actually rise to the challenge. And none of us, I will honestly admit, expected that we would get 141 member states supporting a condemnation of the Russians. When we went into the room, our goal was to get 100, and 141 was extraordinary. And then we were able to maintain that by getting 140 countries to express support for the Ukrainian people. The third thing that has happened that is unusual in the area of Security Council reform, the government of Liechtenstein proposed a resolution that called for members of the P5, when using their veto, to have to come to the General Assembly and explain to other member states why they found it necessary to use their veto. And we co-sponsored that along with other countries. We co-sponsored that resolution. And so it puts pressure on the Russians to have to come and explain themselves before the General Assembly. So I think that kind of action may not have been possible prior to this Russian attack on the core values of the UN system. And there are other discussions that are taking place related to UN reform. And we think those discussions have gotten a bit more exposure and support because of the current situation that we were in the Security Council. But what has happened is, again, I use this over and over, Russia has been isolated. They went into this war thinking that they would defeat the Ukrainians in a matter of 2 weeks. They thought they would divide and break up NATO, and that they would divide the Europeans broadly. And what they've done is actually bolstered NATO's resolve. They have strengthened our alliances with our European colleagues, and they have kind of given the Ukrainians a lot of courage. And the Ukrainians have been able to defend themselves against this onslaught in ways that the Russians didn't expect. And I'm not even sure when the Ukrainians went into this that they realized the strength and resolve and courage that they were going to bring to this fight.
Yeah, that's an interesting adjustment in the international system that bears watching, is just trying to find ways to move the center of gravity to the General Assembly, to other parts of the international system, ad hoc coalitions, obviously, that include NATO, really featuring in the Ukraine context. I wanted to ask you about Syria, because I know you've been focused on this. I know there was a lot of work you did diplomatically to keep a degree of humanitarian access open into Syria. I know that the U.S. has been pledging additional humanitarian assistance. People, I think, have lost sight of this conflict and the suffering that of the Syrian people, given all of the other world events that consume our attention. What is the current state of the U.S. role in Syria, and what have you been focused on through the U.N.?
You know, we have not forgotten about Syria. The dire humanitarian situation facing millions of Syrians remain a significant priority for us. As you know, last year I went to Turkey to the Syrian border to, one, just get a sense of the situation on the ground. So I met with NGOs, I met with the UN, I met with the White Helmets, I met with refugees, and really was able to come back to New York grounded in the situation. We were able to succeed in negotiating with the Russians to get them to agree to a 12-month extension of the one last border, El Ahawa. And that border extension is going to expire on the 10th of July. So I am planning to go again before the extension expires to update myself on the situation on the ground. One thing the Russians asked for last year that we gave them was an agreement that we would do more cross-line distributions of humanitarian assistance. And that effort has worked somewhat. We've had four efforts and we were able to access about 40,000 people. But that only is a mere complement to the millions of people we're feeding cross-line. And so we have to keep cross-line open. And what I've said to the Russians, and I will say to the Syrians, is that this is in their interest because they don't want to see millions of people go into starvation because they're going to feel the impact of this as much as others have. I also, just a few weeks ago, was in Brussels, and we announced an additional $800 million in humanitarian assistance to NGOs and the UN working on Syrian humanitarian programs. So we have not forgotten Syrians. Even in the face of dealing with Ukraine on a daily basis, Syria keeps me awake at night, along with a lot of other world issues. I also certainly think about every day what the DPRK is going to do and how we respond to that. We're engaging on a regular basis with all of the Security Council members, to include Russia and China, on how we respond to that situation.
And what's it like when you have an issue like North Korea, like you mentioned, where you know you're working, as you say, kind of with Russia in a group? I mean, how has that changed since the war in Ukraine started? Is it frostier? Is it more difficult on other issues? Like, has the war in Ukraine spilled over in other issues? Or maybe it should, frankly, given the fact that the Russians have placed themselves so far outside of any international norms.
I mean, we're not engaging business as usual with the Russians, but we know we have to engage with them because we're sitting at the table with them in the Security Council. They're a member of the Security Council. That's a fact. It's a fact that we can't change. So we have to work with them on some of these difficult issues. And I'm hopeful on the issue of Syria that we will get them to agree that it is important that we continue to keep this one border crossing open and that we consider reopening a couple of the other crossings that were closed previously, because this is important. And so I'm willing to engage with them on this issue despite or in spite of our disgust with what they are doing in Ukraine.
And I'm, you know, just as we wrap up here, a couple of broader questions of just, you know, is there an issue that you feel like particularly passionate about pursuing through your role at the UN that may not be getting, you know, the headline attention globally? I mean, I do remember just so many things that had a center of gravity at the UN where you could really make a difference on either addressing a crisis or just trying to make affirmative progress, you know, whether it's on LGBT rights or whether it's on some other aspect of, you know, just trying to take a country that needed that extra assistance from the international community. I mean, what are the one or two things that you would like people to know about that you're working on that are escaping attention?
Well, you know, broadly, Ben, I am really grounded in the humanitarian space. And so I do focus a tremendous amount of of attention on humanitarian issues, on engaging with NGOs and making sure that NGOs get the recognition that they deserve here in the United Nations. So whenever we have events where we are in the chair, we make sure that we have NGOs that are recognized to come and brief the Security Council. We want to make sure that women are also invited in a consistent way. So we hosted, for example, one of our signature events early this week on digital technology. And we had an amazing young woman in the tech field from Kenya come and brief the Security Council. So when I look at what is important to me, in addition to all of the things that are important to all of us, I yeah. want to make sure that we don't let any humanitarian situation be left unnoticed, and that we deal with the situation in Ethiopia, that we continue to focus attention on the situation in Burma, that we focus attention on what is happening with the Uyghurs in China, that Yemen not be forgotten. So it's a huge, huge agenda of humanitarian issues. And for me, every single one is important. So I find myself running on a treadmill because I try to do it all. Because I don't think anything should be forgotten. And Secretary Blinken coined this acronym ROWING, the rest of the world. We cannot forget the rest of the world. And I take that very, very seriously, that Ukraine is important, but the rest of the world is important as well. And what is happening on the humanitarian front in Africa and in Burma and Yemen, all of these are issues that we have to keep in the forefront.
Yeah, no, oftentimes the rest of the world ends up falling into the leadership of the UN ambassador, you know, when the White House gets consumed with things. So I'm glad to hear that perspective. Are you liking the job? Are you making gumbo for your counterparts? Are you enjoying living in New York City? How is it?
I love the job. I'm still getting used to living in New York City. It's been an adjustment coming to New York. I came in the middle of COVID. So the first 6 months, everything was done remotely. So I didn't meet my team. I didn't meet my staff. I chaired my first presidency of the Security Council remotely. So that has required some adjustment. But I am making gumbo. looking forward to sharing it with you and others, because I think it's an important way of engaging with people when you can sit again over a good meal and talk about tough issues. So people relax and they are particularly impressed when they know that I've cooked the meal myself and didn't have it catered or didn't use my really wonderful chef that comes with the apartment. It impresses them that I actually make a meal and serve to them.
Yeah, well, that's good. It's great to hear that. And I just tell you, I've taken a stab at gumbo a bunch of times, and getting that first, you know, that first bit right, you know, it's quite important.
There's a recipe, in the Washington Post. It's my recipe. I actually, when I gave the Washington Post the recipe, I made it up as I was, I made it up to send to them. And then I tried it after I sent it to
Oh, that's a risk. Yeah.
And it was good. It was
good. Good.
It was pretty good. And many people have written to me to say they tried the recipe, including Senator Kaine from Virginia, who said he tried it. He just didn't know what to do with all the gumbo, because you can't make gumbo for four.
Yeah, no,
you have to make gumbo for 12. And
yeah,
so try my recipe in the Washington Post. It'll work for you.
All right, I'm on it. Well, thanks so much for joining, and really appreciate it, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you so much, Ben. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Okay, thank you again to Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield for joining the show. Ben, I have two things I wanted to tell the listeners to read because we didn't have time to cover. It's hard to cover long stories. One is the New York Times did an amazing reporting on Haiti and how the country was forced to pay reparations to the French, their former enslavers, and then take out loans from French banks, which just like compounded the interest over time. And amazing reporting. And then the BBC and a bunch of other outlets, I think, just published a bunch of new documents and photos that detail the crimes against humanity against the Uyghurs by the Chinese government. So
I'll check that out.
And then last question for you. You're currently on one of the funniest reply all mishaps I've ever seen.
Last message was
from Noam Chomsky to about 300 people. How's that going?
I have to say, like, I fired up the Wi-Fi on my flight, and I see, like, an all caps email from Noam Chomsky, which, to begin with, kind of gets your attention.
Yeah.
But then I realized that somebody had, like, sent him some, like, open letter. You know, they didn't like something Noam Chomsky said. But they didn't do the BCC thing. They did the thing where you list every email address.
Brutal.
And let me just say, there are, like, current cabinet officials on this thing. They're all manner of, like, NSC types and, you know,
Journalists
and... And these are like Gmails and stuff too. So
there was an email address allegedly for Boris Johnson on there.
But some assistants, you know, are checking these emails and like, what the hell is going on here?
There's nothing like being on an accidental CC instead of BCC, especially with old people, because inevitably someone gets pissed off and replies all, please remove me from this chain. And that just sets off a chain of angry events from boomers. And it's just the funniest
thing ever. Some people just do the reply all too, like just kind of unself-aware. I will say, I live in fear of doing this, and I did it once. I didn't do the I thought I'd cut and pasted my contacts into the BCC. I did it in the CC, and it was super embarrassing.
It happens to the best of us.
Yeah.
It's always a great way to farm some great email addresses.
You know what? I am going through there, actually, and maybe updating my contacts.
Yeah. Yeah. I see you, Jerome Powell.
Yeah. Okay, Noam Chomsky. You and I are taking this offline.
Noam, now we're friends. All right. That's it for today. Good luck with your inbox. And, talk to you guys soon.
See you.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our producer is Haley Muse. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to Saul Rubin for production support, and to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Milo Kim, and Amelia Montooth, who upload our episodes as videos at youtube.com/crookedmedia.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across 6 Southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries, or listen wherever you get your podcasts.